I should say that if you go to that website, Never Thirst Again, that there's an 8-minute audio-visual gospel presentation there. So you just click the YouTube site, you just click it and it comes up, and sit back, and there's a gospel presentation there. And we're having somewhere around 700 hits a month on that. It depends on how much advertisement we do normally. Through the winter months, we don't do that much with the water. You can understand that up there. We have to keep it from freezing, really. John's Gospel, chapter 21, please. John's Gospel, chapter 21. Trying to build a little bit on what do we do in the last days or in light of the return of Christ, let me suggest that we don't do anything different. The Great Commission was given initially, and that hasn't changed, so you just keep doing that. That's what you do. I'm not saying that our methods perhaps do not change. The message, of course, is the same. And as we see the day approaching, the day of the Lord's return, we remember that the time of our salvation is nearer than when we believe. And we need to take every opportunity to witness, because time is running out. We have to redeem the time. I don't know why it is, but it seems like the longer the Lord delays, the less we think He's really coming somehow. I don't know why that is, but you may have woke up this morning and not even thought that today could be the day. And that's what happens to us, that we get lazy. And we don't consider that this might be the last day on earth for us. So to think about following Him, in each case that we mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, He said, follow me, they did something. Follow me, they did something. Follow me, they did something. So I want to ask you the question, and I don't want you to answer it, I just want you to think about it. Do you love the Lord? That's the question. Do you love the Lord? And I want us to consider that if we're going to follow the Lord, we have to love the Lord. And in order to love the Lord, there are certain things that have to be right in our life. Of course, it's not the first time that question has been asked. Let me read it for you, beginning in verse 14 of John chapter 21. Verse 14, now this is the third time that Jesus showed Himself to His disciples after that He was risen from the dead. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? We'll just pause there for a moment. There's a great debate over what the these are. Some have suggested that it might be the 153 fish that they caught. I doubt that, seriously. However, Peter was a fisherman and he probably loved his job. I'm suggesting for you that this might be an opportunity for Peter to manifest some lessons that he may have learned earlier on. On one occasion before the cross, remember the Lord said that he had to go to the cross and that he had to die. And Peter said, you know, that's not going to be the case. And he also suggested that he would die first before he would deny the Lord, and the Lord prophesied that He'd deny Him three times that night. The indication seems to be that Peter, do you know now that, or would you say now that you love me more than these other disciples? I just throw that out as a possible understanding of that text. Peter responds to that by saying, unto the Lord, Lord, thou knowest that I love you. He certainly didn't say more than these. He saith unto him, feed my lambs. Verse 16, he said to him again, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He said unto him, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He said unto him, feed my sheep. Verse 17, he saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now notice the response. Peter was grieved. He's grieved. Why? Because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus said unto him, feed my sheep. Many things could be said there, and I would suggest that that'd be a great text just to land on for a while and meditate and work through. The point I want to make this morning is this. The Lord asked Peter if he loved him. Peter responded in the positive by saying yes. And the Lord then, if I could paraphrase this, said, well, then do something to prove that. Love is a word of action. It's like this word Jesus says, follow me. They say, okay. But they got to do something. They can't just say, okay. You can't just say, I love the Lord. I'm sorry. That doesn't work. There's got to be corresponding action. Love is a word of action. It's like faith. James says, if a man says he has faith, can faith save him? What kind of faith? Saying faith. Saying faith. Can that kind of faith save you? No. No, that kind of faith can't save you. I can say anything. I mean, who would want to be the president of General Motors? But I can tell you this morning, I'm the president of General Motors. Does that make me the president of General Motors? Of course not. But I said it, didn't I? Yes. Watch this. I'm a Christian. That make me a Christian? No. But I said it, didn't I? See, love's like that. Love is a word of action. God did not sit in heaven and say, I love you. He demonstrated it. He stepped out of heaven. He came to earth. He did something to prove it. Love has a corresponding action to follow or is not love. Gentlemen, sometimes your wife will say to you, she'll say, honey, tell me you love me. And we'll go, I love you. That's not what she wants, of course, you know. She wants you to hug her and take her on a long walk or something, you know. Women love to walk. That's amazing. I say, why walk if you can ride? That's my philosophy. My wife, she'd walk everywhere if she could, you know. What is she really saying? What is God really saying? There must be something to prove that. There's corresponding action. Peter, you love me? Yeah, feed me sheep. Peter, you love me? Yeah, feed me lamb. Peter, you love me? Yeah, show me. Show me. Okay? Now keep that in mind. Go to John 14. John 14. John 14, verse 15. Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. There's got to be corresponding action to follow. If you love me, keep my commandments. Look again in verse 21. He that has my commandments and keepeth them, he it is that loveth me. And he that loveth me shall be loved of my Father. And I will love him. How will we know that? And will manifest myself to him. God commended, he demonstrated his own love. How did he do that? Christ came. God showed it. There's corresponding action. Look at verse 23. If a man love me, Jesus said, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him. How will we know that? And we will come unto him and will make our abode with him. This is a two-way thing. God didn't sit in heaven and say, I love you, and we don't stand on earth and say, I love God. This is a reciprocal thing. God shows it, we show it. And you cannot say, I love the Lord and do nothing. You can't. You cannot say, I am following the Lord and do nothing. There is corresponding action. There has to be corresponding action. So I would think that we could establish this point that there is a responsibility to love. If you're going to say, I love the Lord, then it's only hypocritical unless you're doing something to prove that. Okay, let's go to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. In verse 36, the Lord is at the Pharisee's house, Simon. And while he's there, a lady comes in and, well, let's read it in verse 37. Behold, a woman in that city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment and stood behind his feet weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw it, he spake within himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that touches him, because she is a sinner. Jesus answered and said, Simon, I have something to say unto thee. And he said, Master, say on. He said, There was a certain creditor which had two debtors, and one owed 500 pence and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, You have rightly judged. And he turned to the woman. But he said to Simon, Do you see this woman? When I entered into thy house, thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil you did not anoint, but this woman has anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. She loved much because she had been forgiven much. You can't turn that around. You can't say she is forgiven much because she loved much. That would be a salvation by works. But you can say she loved much because she understood how much she had been forgiven. Now, I got to ask you, how much have you been forgiven? Because that's how much you love. We've really done an injustice to our young people who've been raised in Christian homes, and I publicly apologize to them. Because we don't think they have very much of a testimony. People love for me to give my testimony because I was so stupid before I got saved. Watch this. Here's the door of salvation right here. I was way over there to your right, my left. Out of sight. Way away from God. By the grace of God, I heard the gospel, desired to know the Lord, trusted it. Changed my life. Come all the way from over there and got over here. Wonderful. Big distance. Great change. Wonderful conversion experience. So people say, oh, Brother Joe, come and tell your story. It's a wonderful story. Well, I tell my story and people go, oh, you needed the Lord. You were terrible, you know. As what? As though they didn't? See, this is my point. This is my point. Get my wife to tell her story. She might have taken the cookie out of the cookie jar when she wasn't supposed to one time as a little girl. That's about it. point, going to the same hell for eternity. How much has she been forgiven? See, here's what we teach. Now, don't get little Johnny on the platform. He doesn't have anything to say. He was saved when he was four. You know, and he came up through the Sunday school, and by the grace of God, he'd just gone on. But he didn't really have a testimony. And this is what we communicate. Little Johnny's standing right here. Here's the door of salvation. And one day, little Johnny got saved. Okay? So we never ask little Johnny to give his testimony. But what we're saying to him is, little Johnny, you didn't get saved much. So how much do you love little Johnny? Oh, not much. I don't have a big testimony. What we got to understand is this thing, one works on the other. If she loves much because she's understood how much she's been forgiven, well, then if you love much, you obey, right? We just said there's corresponding action. Something has to happen here. You're proving that. So if I understand that I'm not saved very much here, I didn't have much to confess. I've just been forgiven a little bit. I'm just going to love a little bit. If I'm just going to love a little bit, then I'm not showing my love to the Lord very much. So this thing complicates one another. My point is, you've got to understand how much you've been forgiven, and whether you were standing at the threshold of salvation or you were on the other side of the world makes absolutely no difference. Everybody's going to the same spot without Christ. Everybody's got the same judgment without... I mean, you're going to the great white throne without Christ. And you got delivered from that. I have three children, and by the grace of God, my two boys were saved when they were around 5 years old. My daughter, she was six. We thought she'd never get saved. You know what I mean? Like, whoa, you know? And God has delivered them from a horrible life. Now, what's is greater? I think, personally, by the time my kids were in their late teens and early 20s, they were so far ahead. They knew the Scriptures. They were living for the Lord. They're going on. They're serving God. I mean, I didn't get saved till I was 25. They had a head start. I mean, it's incredible. We think that the best guys, the biggest guys, the most powerful testimonies, the greatest preachers are those who God plucked as a brand from the burnings. Well, let me tell you, that's what everybody was to start with, so don't worry about that. But we think that nobody can say it or do it like them, but the Scriptures are quite different. And I'll tell you why. At the end of Paul's life, I mean, Paul, come on. This is the biggest testimony in the New Testament, the conversion of Saul of Tarsus, who's incarcerating Christians and hunting them down. I mean, but who does he hand the baton to at the end of his life? Who? Who is the only guy that is like-minded? Who? Timothy. 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 Who more or less got saved on his grandmother's knee. Come on. Got nobody like-minded like Timothy, he said. Everybody else has done something else. But Timothy, and he takes the thing and he hands it to somebody that didn't have a Damascus Road experience. We got to understand it. You need to get your young people on the platform and an opportunity to share their testimony and encourage them and tell them to go on. Tell them, you know, Mr. Moody came back from a series of meetings and they said, Mr. Moody, how many got saved? And he said, 2.5. And they said, oh, 2 adults and a child? He said, no, 2 children, 1 adult. The adult's got a half a life to live for the Lord and the children got a whole life. That's my point, folks. Don't minimize that. And so what we have to do is we have to teach all of us that whether we're half a world away or whether we grew up in a Christian home and one night with our mother said, I want Jesus to come into my heart, that salvation is the greatest thing that could ever happen. They've been delivered from a devil's hell. They've been forgiven much and they need to understand that so they can love much. Does that make sense to you? It makes perfect sense to me. There's corresponding action. If you've been forgiven a little, you're just going to love a little. Maybe that's what's happened to some of our young people. We haven't encouraged them. We get the big shots on the platform. Well, the big shots are no shots at all. I can tell you about them. There's no big shots. There's a big God. And they're little servants. And we need to understand this principle. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. So, could we fairly say there's a degree of love? To the degree that I understand how much I've been forgiven, to that degree I'm going to love Him. And to the degree that I love Him, I'm going to obey Him. And that means I'm going to be following Him. So there's the duty of love, there's the degree of love, and I want you to notice this, there's a desire of love. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier. I've just, in my outline, I've entitled this section, The Desire of Love, Motivated by Love. Why do you do what you do? Why does the soldier in the text do what he's done? The comparison is the civil with the military. Okay? Civil life and military life in most cases don't mix. Can you imagine a soldier jumping up out of a trench in Afghanistan saying it's 5 o'clock, it's quitting time, I'm going back to the barracks for the night? Well, that doesn't happen. You cannot mix. You cannot be at war and be concerned about how much gas is in Tampa, Florida. You can't get your mind. You gotta pay attention to what's going on. Now, why would you go through the struggle? Why would you be in the battle? Why would you separate yourself, the civil, the military? Why would you do it? Here's the reason. That he might please him who's chosen him to be a soldier. Let me ask you this. What would you do for the Lord? Careful. Be careful how you answer that. I can remember vividly when I understood. It took me about 2 weeks to really get a hold of this thing, you know, about salvation. I mean, finally I go, wow, this is big. This is the real deal here, you know. And so I remember saying, Lord, I'll go anywhere, do anything. Headhunters, crocodile-infested rivers. Anywhere, anytime, anything. Except I'd never go back to school. I just wouldn't do that. You know, I'm not a good student. I just wouldn't want to go to school. You know, I wouldn't want to do that. So for the next 7 years, I get to go to school. It's amazing, you know. Nobody is more unlearned than me. I went to Bible school with my Bible, my pen, and my notebook all in my shirt pocket. I didn't have a clue. I never read a book in my life. I couldn't read very good at all. So you don't do things you're not good at. You know, I don't play golf. Isn't that supposed to be relaxing? I said, God forbid. That's the most... I wouldn't do that for anything, you know. So I didn't read. So I didn't... The first book I ever read was the Bible. I was 26 years old, read the Bible. Never read a comic book, never read a novel, never read a fiction book in school, bought all my book reports, you know, cheated my way through junior college, you know. But I said to the Lord, I'd go to Bible school, you know. I can't believe that I actually did that myself. I mean, it's just the grace of God that I did that. But I can tell you why I did it. I wanted to please the Lord. I mean, I'm totally out of my comfort zone. You got to understand that. I mean, I am completely removed from anything that I have any ability to do. I had absolutely no ability to do it. And I went through 4 years of Bible school, and I'll tell you what, I just hesitate to tell people. They think I know something, you know. I don't know anything. I just endured for 4 years. You know? And if it hadn't been for my wife and the Lord's grace, I would have never got out of that place, you know. But it was a good discipline for me. I learned a lot, but it was a good discipline for me because I got out of my comfort zone. And I realized that I had to do this. So this is what the Lord was asking me to do. And I wanted to do it because I wanted to please the Lord. Many times I tried to quit. Many times. And the Lord in His grace helped me not to quit. Because I know I wanted to please the Lord. So what is your motive? Why do you pick up Sunday school kids? Why do you let them take the muddy little feet and get them on your carpet and your new whatever you got? Why do you go through the struggles at work trying to balance the time for the assembly and the time at work? And your family and your hobbies and your sports? And why is it that by the grace of God you're always just able to put Him a little bit ahead of everything else, and you know there's a cost and you're willing to do it? Why do you do it? If it's because of a nagging wife, I'm going to tell you, you will give up on that. You will. If because you're trying to please your elders or some preacher came by and said, this is what you got to do, you will give up on that. But if it's because you want to please the Lord, He will help you to do that. He will give you the grace to do that. So love has a duty. Yes, you got to obey the Lord. You've got to show Him there's an obedience. Love has a degree to it. As much as I understand that I've been forgiven, to that degree I'm going to love Him, and to that degree I'm going to serve Him. And love also has a desire. You've seen this happen. A boy meets girl, they fall in love, they're dating, there's a wedding, there's an engagement ring, there's a date set, and you see this guy, he just cannot do enough. He just cannot do enough. He is totally motivated from every moment, every second of his life is dedicated to that relationship. And she can't get enough. She's everything that he ever wanted, and he is everything that she ever wanted, and this is just the perfect thing. And then they get married. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And the honeymoon's over. It's absolutely amazing. You know? And formerly, he wasn't a very good tennis player, and so she just laid back until, you know, made him look good. Now she just drives him home. I mean, you know? And he used to open the door for her. Get in the car, we're late, you know. I mean, it's amazing, you know. It's amazing. What happened? They lose their motive. Huh? Why are they doing it? Oh, but at first they wanted to please the other. Folks, don't let that happen to you spiritually. Don't let that happen to you in your marriage. The desire of love. Look at Revelation 2. Revelation 2. I've been full-time in the Lord's work, so-called. There's some people with secular jobs that are full-time in the Lord's work, and we need to recognize that. You don't have to be travel all over the country and have letters of commendation to be full-time in the Lord's work. And we need to encourage those people who God has allowed to work for Him in other capacities full-time like that, self-supporting or whatever they're doing. But I've been so-called in the Lord's work since 1976. This would be about 1982. And I came home from a week of meetings, and I said to my wife, I said, the whole thing is a joke. She said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm over there telling people how to have the abundant life, and I don't even have it myself. Now that in itself was bad, but what was to come next was worse. She said to me, I feel the same way. See, my wife is rock solid. I mean, I lean on her. She's the most godliest person I've ever met in my life. The Lord has given me a woman like that because He knows how much I need a helpmeet like that, and particularly in the ministry that I'm in. So when she said that, I knew we were in trouble. So it was my wife that said, we better get on our knees and read Revelation chapter 2. So we did. And this is what we read, beginning in verse 2. I know thy works, and thy labor, and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil, and how thou canst hast tried them which say they are apostles and are not, and hast found them to be liars, and hast labored or borne, and hast patience, and for my name's sake you have labored, and you have not fainted. Let me pause there and say, that really was our life. Even though I didn't have the joy of the Lord, I want to communicate to you by the grace of God, I wasn't backslidden as such. I wasn't going by. I wasn't doing anything stupid. I wasn't living in a life of sin. I just didn't have the joy. And I can totally relate to this, that we worked and worked and worked and worked and worked and worked. And unintentionally, what happened to me was, I felt that if I was not close enough to the Lord, maybe it was because I wasn't doing enough. I mean, I didn't get saved till later in life, and, you know, I served the Father of the dark for all those years, and it made perfect good sense to me to serve the Father of lights now. And if I don't know if you were like me, but I'd stay up all night serving the devil before I got saved. Why wouldn't I stay up all night serving the Almighty? My goodness, that certainly I could do that. So any time that I felt that I was away from the Lord a bit, I felt it probably is because I wasn't doing enough. And so you pick the pace up. You do a little more, do a little more. You know, if the devil can't get you to slow down or backslide or get distracted or you get sin in your life, he'll just give you a little encouragement. Just go, go. Go, go. And the next thing you know, you're way out there, and the Lord's back here. And you're operating in the flesh. The ministry became an occupation. The ministry became a job. The ministry became a burden. And now I don't have any joy anymore in the work. And I could totally relate to that. I'd had patience, and I'd labored, and I didn't faint, and I went on, and I went on. But the next verse says in verse 4, nevertheless, I have somewhat against you because you left your first love. Remember that last text? Why the soldier does all that? Because he wants to please the one. Remember that motive? I lost it. Do you have the zeal you had when you got saved? Do you have the desire today to serve the Lord like you did when you got saved? Has it become routine, mechanical? It's possible that someone here can identify with what I'm saying, that they have left their first love. I always thought, well, you lost it. You don't really lose it. You leave it. Now, I'm not saying you leave it intentionally. I don't think most people do. But they leave it. They replace it. The motivation of loving the Lord. Remember how this goes? If I love Him, I'll do something. If I love Him, I understand how much I've been forgiven. If love works in my life and it motivates me along. When this thing, when it goes south, let me tell you something. It affects every area of your life. You know, God doesn't want your time or your hand or your mind or your feet or your pocketbook. He wants your heart. That's what He wants. Because, you see, we can give Him all that other and not give Him our heart. He wants your heart. And when He's got your heart, He's got everything. And what we need to understand about this text is that it's easy, it's common, It's possible that people sitting here today have left their first love. You're not bad people. I'm not saying you're bad people. But I'm saying that motive that gripped you initially, that you just couldn't get enough, somehow has been replaced. And so what I'm going to suggest at this part is that there's possible that you have, just for our alliteration, departed from love. You left it. The reason I know that you leave it is because he tells us in the verses to follow what to do. And so we got on our knees that day. We read this text, and I said, I'm guilty. I just know it. Can't dance around this. It's gone. And so notice in verse 5, you've got the remedy that love is a decision. Verse 5, remember, therefore, from whence you are fallen, and repent, and notice, and do what? First, works. Works, that's what I was motivated when I first got saved. I was motivated and I did all this stuff. Why? Because I loved the Lord. And as I did that, it was evidence that I loved Him. So the first works are evidence that you love the Lord. Why? Motivated by nothing else but just my appreciation for Him. That was all. So remember whence thou art fallen. You know what we had to do? We had to get on our knees. We had to go back and we'd say, Lord, we're going to trace some steps back here and say, how did we ever not do it for you? So that's the point. Where does the motive of love, where did it stop? Where did we start replacing that with something else for the reason we're doing what we're doing? So love is a decision. We had to make a decision that day to go back and to tell the Lord that we had left our motive, left our first love. Everything works against you when your love relationship with the Lord is wrong. Now everything is affected. My ministry is affected. My life with my wife is affected. My relationship to my assembly is affected. My relationship to other believers are affected. Why? I'm out of sync. I'm out of step with the Lord. I'm outwardly, you'd see me continuing on doing the same thing, but inwardly, I'm empty. And so that day we said, Lord, we don't feel like a lot is happening here, but according to your word, we're going to go back and we're going to do first works again. We're going to, by faith, tell you that we're doing this for you. And like the nursing home story, you don't get it till you do it. God gives you the feelings once you make the decision to do what is right. And that day we made a decision to go back and do first works. And I tell you, it's daily. You don't ever get away from it. Everybody is a target. There are no people exempt from having struggles in your Christian life like that. But love is a decision. It's not a feeling. You know, when the Lord tells us in through John's epistle, love not the world, He didn't ask you how you feel about that. Says this is something you make a decision to do. And if I don't love the world, then I won't obey the world. I won't cater to the world. The world won't cater to me. If I love the Lord, I will obey the Lord. I will cater to Him. He will cater to me. This is a two-way thing. So the duty of love, the degree of love, the desire of love, the departure of love, and the decision of love. I have a friend who was born in Singapore. He's East Indian. By the time he was 19 years old, he was head of part of the organized crime in Singapore. He had so much influence. He was trained by superiors. He had so much influence by the time he was 19 that a corrupt political party contacted him and asked him, would he help them get elected? He said, if you help our party get into power, we'll make you the mayor of Singapore. He always wanted to have a lot of authority and a lot of power. Even at 19 years old, he thought that'd be great. I'd love to be the mayor of Singapore. And so I don't know how you do that, but they did that, and that corrupt party got in. And one day, limousines and everything pulled up to his flat where he was living, and he thought, for sure, they'll make me the mayor of Singapore. And they arrested him, put him in prison. They just used him. That's all they did. He knew too much. He was too influential. And so now he's in prison. While he was in prison, he tried to escape. And he was caught, actually, before he made the effort to escape. They put him in what they call the condemned cell. It's what we'd call solitary confinement. And took him by the prison library, and they said, you can have one book before you go into the condemned cell. He said, I'll take that one. He said, it was the biggest book on the shelf. I didn't know how long I was going into the condemned cell, so I'll get the big book. They locked the door behind him, only to find out it was the Bible. And he threw it against the wall and thought to himself, how stupid could I be? I'm locked in a condemned cell. I've got nothing but a Bible. He said, after a few weeks, I didn't go anywhere, and neither did the Bible. He said, I picked it up. I started to read it, reading in the Old Testament. And he said, oh, it wasn't bad. He says, a lot of fighting back there. I like that, he said. And so I thought, maybe I can pick up some tips on fighting. And eventually he said, they didn't know anything about fighting, he said, in the Old Testament. I didn't learn much from them. By the time he was in prison, he was expert in martial arts and all other kind of stuff. And so he started in the New Testament, started reading the New Testament. He read in the New Testament, what would it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lost his own soul? And he said that really disturbed him. He wanted to be the mayor of Singapore. He wanted to own Singapore. He wanted to own the world. This was his struggle, power and might and reputation. And he said it made him so mad he threw it down and he didn't pick it up for a couple of weeks. He said, I wasn't interested in it at all. And again, he didn't go anywhere, neither the Bible. He picks it back up. He skips on to the next gospel. He decides he's going to just forget that. Let's read something else. He's reading along in the next gospel and he comes to this verse. What would it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lost his own soul? You ever wonder why the gospels repeat, you know? Well, I'll cut the story to real short here. He read it the third time in another gospel, and the Lord began to speak to him. By the time he got through the gospels, he got a burden. He began to understand something about Jesus Christ, and he read through Acts. He got to Romans. Faith comes by hearing. He said, how would I overhear when I'm here in this prison? So he said, I guess I better read it out loud, he said. So he starts reading the scriptures out loud. Now, in the condemned cell, both ends of that cell had a door and a window, and they were monitored 24 hours a day because people in there try to hurt themselves, you know, so they monitor them. He said, would you believe it? The two guards got saved because I'm reading the scriptures out loud to them. He got saved. The two guards got saved. 300 people in the prison got saved. The warden got saved. Eventually, he got put back in to the regular, whatever they call that, in prison, out of the condemned cell. And the corrupt party planted a man in there to kill him. So now he's in the cell with this other guy. And he said, they planted this guy in here to kill me. And he said, I led him to the Lord, you know. And he said, I thought I led him to the Lord. He said, one night we were kneeling in prayer, and he stabbed me with two knives. One in my neck, which lodged in my shoulder, and the other in my kidney. And he said, I stood up. You'd have to know this guy. He said, I pulled this one out. And I've got my own blood dripping off these two knives. And he said, I turned to him and I said, you're in trouble now. And this guy went ballistic. The guards came. He took Ramalingam, my friend, away back to a condemned cell. And I don't know what happened to the other guy at that point, but then he said with a twinkle in his eye, and he's got this gold tooth right here, and he said, and then I really did lead him to the Lord. He said, you know. He eventually got out of that situation. He was so known in Singapore in those days, 1971, that his conversion, he used to carry it in the paper, his conversion was in an article in the local paper. And he would show, you know, ex-criminal turns religious or something, whatever it was, but that's how known he was. Now, I told you that part of the story to get to this, actually. He is one of only two people in Singapore that can go on death row to the prison in Singapore to present Christianity to those on death row. And I said to him, how many people do you feel get saved that you talk to? He said about 90% would get saved. He said, I tell them, don't let them try everything else first. Don't talk to me. Don't even call me until they've given up, because no other religion, no other philosophy other than true Christianity can offer them any hope at all. And so he said about 90%. He said, in 1981, 18 men in a conspiracy robbed an establishment to steal gold bars. And in the process, a man was killed. They were apprehended and taken. All 18 of them were caught. Singapore laws are very strict. One man died, 18 men convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to hang to death in Singapore. He said, I had the privilege of seeing 16 of those men come to the Lord. And I had a very short, less than a year, a very short period of time, listen to this, to get them ready to meet Jesus. Can you believe this? He's discipling these guys, you know. And most of them, he said they were between 18 and 35 years old. Most of them couldn't read or write. They were, for the most part, Muslims. They would write letters. They would send letters, drawing pictures, if you can believe it, back to their loved ones. When their loved ones visited, many of their family got saved. And then he said the day of their execution came. And he said, I was there. He said, I'd spent best part of a year with them. They hung them three at a time. And he said, they walked by me going to the gallows. And he said, I was weeping. He said, I got to know these men. He said, they were brothers in Christ. And he said, I was weeping. And one guy came by and said, Ramalingam, don't cry. I said, I'm going to see Jesus now. He said, I believe that. I know that. I teach that. I preach that. But he said, this man standing 18 inches in front of me in 5 minutes is going to be standing in the presence of Jesus Christ. He said, that truth never hit me so hard in my life. Usually the hardest criminals in the place, usually what happens is when they see the gallows, their legs go like jelly. They drag them in. All 16 of these guys walked in. They quoted Bible verses. They witnessed to the executioner. These men were truly saved. He stood there weeping. A guy comes by and says, Ramalingam, I'm going to be with Jesus now. He said, do you have a message you would like for me to deliver for you? What message would you send today? You know what Ramalingam told us? Tell the Lord I love Him. Tell the Lord I love Him. But if He's not manifesting that, that's a lie. If he's not obeying the Lord, if he's not following the Lord, that's a lie. It's no good. If a man loves me, he keeps my word. He obeys my voice. I asked you at the beginning of this message, I said, I want to ask you a question I don't want you to answer, because this is big. This is not, oh, I love the Lord. So in closing, do you love the Lord? How much? How much? Let's pray.